Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
This week, former Governor Branstad lost a $1.5 million discrimination lawsuit. This hour, we'll find out why. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll hear from Roxanne Conlon, the attorney in that case. Also this hour, a home state view of 2020 presidential candidate Jay Inslee, how the late rapper Tupac Shakur fits into an Iowa news story, and thoughts from an Iowa astrophysicist on the 50th anniversary of the first lunar landing. Buckle up for your news buzz. Blast off follows this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the hour, in just a few minutes, a home state view. Our series continues, a view this time of the 2020 presidential candidate Jay Inslee. Also, how the late rapper Tupac Shakur fits into an Iowa news story this week, and thoughts from an Iowa astrophysicist on the 50th anniversary of the first lunar landing. But first, this week, we learned that former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad lost a $1.5 million discrimination lawsuit. A jury awarded a gay former state official $1.5 million in damages. The eight-person jury found that former Governor Branstad discriminated against this former official named Chris Godfrey based on his sexual orientation. Let's talk with Roxanne Conlon, one of Godfrey's attorneys, Roxanne Conlon with Roxanne Conlon and Associates of Des Moines. Roxanne, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much.
So how much of a surprise was this jury decision and the award for you and your team?
Well, it wasn't a surprise. It's something that we had been working toward for more than 8 years. So we were gratified by it. We are very satisfied with it, and Chris is overjoyed to have finally gotten the justice that he was pursuing for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Before you take us back 7 or 8 years to the start of this whole legal battle, let's talk about the damages. Why $1.5 million? What's that for?
That is for sexual orientation discrimination, retaliation after he refused to resign, and violation of his due process rights by failing to give him any chance, even a chance to say hello, in terms of the day that they cut his salary.
Okay, let's go back to that day. When was it? Give us some background. Walk us up to the day of the firing. What is it? Something like 8 years ago.
He was never fired. He, in December of 2010, when Governor-elect Branstad was seeking to put his own team in place, the governor wrote Chris a letter and said, "We want you to resign." Chris wrote him back and said, "No, I'm not going to resign. I have a term of years. I'm not like the people who serve at the pleasure of the governor. I am an apolitical person. The legislature and previous governors decided that the Workers' Compensation Commissioner should be a person free of political influence." The governor then asked Chris to come to a meeting on December 29th and asked him again to resign. And Chris told him about all the advances that he had made in the Workers' Compensation Division, how he had reduced the backlog to a point where it had practically never been. The backlog is the number of cases pending on appeal for injured workers. And, of course, they don't get the money that they may be entitled to until after those decisions are made. But that was not very impressive to the governor. Nonetheless, Chris heard nothing for 6 months. And then on July 11th, he went to the governor's office at the request of Jeff Boyink, the chief of staff, and met with Mr. Boyink and Brenna Finley for 2 minutes, really 2 minutes, in which they said, "Are you going to resign?" And he said, "No, I'm not." And they said, "Would you resign if you knew that your salary was going to be cut to the lowest amount allowed by law?" And He said no, and then they said, you know, your salary is going to be a lot lower. And indeed, they cut his salary by $39,000.
Mm-hmm. Roxanne Conlon, when did he seek your intervention?
I talked to him on the day this happened. He's a good friend. He was my former law clerk. We went through the confirmation battles together. So he called me on that day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the next day, I want your listening audience to understand. The next day, I called Brenna Finley, the governor's lawyer, and I said to her, "Brenna, this is wrong. I want you to restore Chris's salary, and I want the governor to apologize. And we're gone. It's over." She called me back a few days later and said that would not be happening. So we started the process of suing the state of Iowa and the governor and Brenna.
Okay. Give us the details of this civil lawsuit that was finally decided in favor of your client, $1.5 million in damages. What were the main points you had to get across to this jury, which agreed with you this week?
One of the main points, one of the defenses that the governor put forward was that he couldn't discriminate against Chris because he didn't even know that he was gay. The jury rejected that because everybody knew that Chris was gay, and everyone on the governor's staff, including Brenna Finley and Jeff Boink, knew that Chris Godfrey was gay. He has been openly gay since the late 90s, and it was not a secret, and literally everybody on the governor's staff knew that he was gay. So it seemed to us and to the jury as though that was probably not true, that Branstad did know he was gay. And also, Chris was the only openly gay executive officer in the state of Iowa. And when you single out someone who is in a protected class, you better have a good defensible reason. And the governor did not have a good defensible reason. His defense, in fact, was I had to try to get rid of him because my big donors and my supporters didn't like it that he was deciding so many cases in favor of employees who were injured.
You mentioned protected class. Give us the roots of that in Iowa law.
And Iowa passed a civil rights statute in 1965 that included race, color, creed, place of national origin. In 1972, I think, they amended it to include sex. And more recently, they amended the act to include disability, age, and then in 2007, added sexual orientation. And that means that you cannot discriminate on the basis of a person being in one of those protected classes in employment, housing, public accommodations, and education.
Mm-hmm. So this verdict wraps up a six-week trial that wraps up, well, I don't, this is the question, whether it does wrap up this seven or eight years of a, isn't that the question?
Yeah, that is the question, and I am pretty sure that it doesn't wrap it up. As satisfying as it is to hear the verdict from a jury of his peers for Chris and certainly for me and the other members of the team, it isn't over. They're probably going to appeal and spend another $1 million of the taxpayers' money doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Just to be clear, this $1.5 million is taxpayer money.
Absolutely.
And whatever comes next in the further legal battle will be taxpayers' money, should it be decided in the same way.
Yes. And the state of Iowa has already paid Terry Branstad's private lawyers more than $1 million. And I don't think they've gotten the bill yet for the trial of this case. They will also be liable for my attorney's fees for 8 years and a six-week trial, and for the fees of all of the people who helped try this case.
That's in addition to the $1.5 million.
Absolutely.
In a round figure, can you give us an idea of what the legal fees here are?
Oh, I'm trying to figure that out, as a matter of fact, but I did get the costs today. Costs are different than fees. It's the expert witnesses.
Okay. Hundreds of thousands? I'll start there. You can direct
them. No, the costs are $250,000. That's the money we paid out in order to get this case to trial. And we get to be reimbursed for that money.
Okay.
About months or so before intensive trial preparation began. My attorney's fees were $2.9 million.
Mm-hmm. Why did this lawsuit take so long?
Two trips to the Supreme Court, for one thing, both of which I won, one of which I think is extremely important because it was the first case in the state of Iowa to decide that individual citizens whose rights are trampled on by the government have a cause of action against the government for individual damages. And that's a very important constitutional claim. And so that's one of the reasons. The other reasons are I bet you I took 50 depositions, and some of them lasted for 3 days. There was a lot of work to be done in order to prevail against the state of Iowa and its most powerful citizen, the governor of the state.
Mm-hmm. To give a little voice of what he had to say during the trial, he said, "During the trial, I have always treated everyone, gay or straight, with respect and dignity. That's the way I have always operated." That was Branstad during the trial. The spokesman for Governor Reynolds, Pat Garrett, just said, "We are disappointed in the verdict and are consulting with our attorneys." I guess no indication in that report, the latest report I saw, whether the state will appeal. You're betting they will, it sounds like. Talk a little bit more in a minute or two that we have left about Chris Godfrey's reaction. I think you said overjoyed. Is he complete?
Yes.
Is he completely satisfied?
Yes, I think that he is completely satisfied. It was never about the money. It was about the governor went all over the state of Iowa after this happened and said that Chris Godfrey, an administrative law judge, a person who must be unbiased, was biased against employers. He tried to destroy Chris Godfrey's reputation in retaliation for Chris Godfrey speaking out on his discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And Chris feels vindicated by the jury.
He wanted that apology. Does he still want an apology?
He absolutely did. He still would like an apology, but, you know, the $1.5 million is certainly justice.
Okay. In 30 seconds, that's all we have left, Roxanne. Fascinating here. What do you feel are the takeaways for employers, for those who feel they've been discriminated against based on sexual orientation?
Well, the takeaways are that it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. Employers should not permit it to happen, and employees who feel that they have been the victim of sexual orientation discrimination should file a complaint with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission.
Thank you very much, Roxanne Conlan, one of the attorneys for Chris Godfrey. Roxanne Conlan of Conlan, Roxanne Conlan and Associates of Des Moines. An 8-person jury finding that former Governor Terry Branstad discriminated against his former official Chris Godfrey based on sexual orientation in a civil lawsuit, awarding him $1.5 million in damages. Roxanne Conlan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, now let's continue with our Home State View series, in which we focus on the individual Democratic presidential candidates by talking with someone in the media from their home state who's been covering them for some time. Today, let's get a home state view of the governor of Washington State and presidential candidate Jay Inslee. Joining us to do that, Jim Bruner. He's a political reporter with the Seattle Times, and he's joining us from a bustling Seattle Times newsroom. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I understand you've covered politics with the Seattle Times for more than 20 years. Tell us a little bit about the political rise of Jay Inslee there in that state.
Sure. Well, Jay Inslee, you know, started out before politics as kind of a small town lawyer in central Washington. He eventually ran for Congress over there, and so actually represented a little more of a conservative area of the state, a part of the state now that has no Democrats representing it, hasn't for quite some time. So he was elected in 1992, which was kind of a Democratic wave. He lost in a Republican wave in 1994, in part, as he will say often on the campaign trail, because he voted for the assault weapons ban. He made his way over to the western side of the state, you know, closer to Seattle, where it's a little more Democratic Friendly was elected, served in Congress for more than a decade, ran for governor in 2012, and he's in his second term now, and he surprised maybe a bunch of people by running for president. We haven't had a Washington State politician run for president since Scoop Jackson in 1976.
That's interesting. What are the issues Jay Inslee is running on? Do they match up with issues that he's been backing there in Washington State all along?
Well, largely on his central issue. And if you know anything about Jay Inslee, he's made it very clear that his number one issue is climate change. He's kind of a little bit of a one-note candidate, but he would argue that that issue transcends all kinds of other issues, that it's a health issue and a security issue, for example. And he's not a newcomer to that. He was a big clean energy advocate in Congress. He created, as governor, a clean energy fund. He's pushed, with limited success, I would say, for reducing, you know, programs to reduce greenhouse gases in Washington State, wasn't successful in getting people to approve a carbon tax, but he's not a newcomer. You know, he wrote a book on this in 2007 called Apollo's Fire, co-authored a book about making, you know, a transition to a clean energy economy the central thrust of the United States, comparing it to the space program. And that is definitely his main issue as he is running for president.
Mm-hmm. How much are the people of Washington State on board with that more aggressive posture towards climate change?
Well, like I said, it's been mixed. Washington State, you know, until recently still had a divided legislature with Republicans controlling one of the chambers, and so it made it quite difficult to pass climate legislation that was perceived as, you know, indeed probably would have raised utility prices, gas prices through some kind of carbon pricing. We're a relatively low emission state anyway. Much of our power is from hydroelectric dams. That puts us in an advantageous position. So it's been mixed. You know, it's been interesting. I haven't detected a huge amount of enthusiasm for Jay Inslee's presidential campaign in this state. There, he definitely has his supporters, but you don't see large, you know, rallies. Other candidates come here have gotten more attention than him so far. Of course, I wouldn't say he's spending a lot of his time campaigning in his own state. That would probably be a mistake anyway.
Mm-hmm. In this series, Jim, we like to ask how candidates deal with criticism. When Jay Inslee has faced criticism for his stance on climate change or other things, how does he typically react?
Well, on the climate question, you know, the pushback that you get often or that he gets is it's unrealistic or there would be too high a cost, it would be too big of a shock to the economy. And he doesn't, you know, in a way he likes to talk around that. And that's been true for some issues in his own state. He likes to shift the argument to saying, well, the price of doing nothing is worse. And so I'm not going to talk about, you know, what it might cost you during this transition to a more clean energy economy. I'm going to talk about the jobs that you know, that he thinks can be created. And again, the vast cost and the damage that will be done if there's no action. And that reminds me kind of, I guess, an episode in his gubernatorial career. When he ran in 2012 for governor of Washington, he faced a, you know, probably one of the better Republican candidates we've had in Washington State in a long time for governor. It's been something like 40 years since we've had a Republican governor in Washington State. And to kind of blunt the idea that he would be a tax and spend Democrat, Jay Inslee promised not to raise taxes or not to seek new taxes. He said he couldn't possibly imagine how that could even happen because his plan would be to grow the economy and bring in revenue that way. Well, it wasn't too long before, after he got elected governor, that he indeed proposed, you know, billions and billions in new taxes, including a carbon tax and others. You know, when he's criticized over that, again, he kind of talked around it, said that he, you know, his first budget, he didn't propose these new taxes, and so it wasn't a big problem. So, you know, he's not a guy who will sort of react angrily, typically, I would say, to criticism. Mm-hmm. He'll more talk around it, change the subject, like a lot of politicians.
Right. We do know that from other politicians. Give us a sense of his staff, the team he has, the people he surrounds himself with.
Well, one thing I'll say is he has a pretty loyal staff, a loyal group of political aides, and some of whom have gone in and out of his administration too, who have been with him for a long time. And I think, you know, you know that there's been news about other people in the presidential race, Senator Klobuchar, for example.
Yeah, that she's more difficult.
Not being kind.
Right, difficult to work for at times. Demanding.
Yeah, Janesley doesn't have that reputation, I would say. In fact, he almost has a reputation as being maybe a little lackadaisical, a little casual. I think he's a likable guy. I think the people that work for him like him. And so when you look at the team that he's put around himself when he's running for president, it's a lot of people that have been around him in previous campaigns. There's not a lot of new blood. There isn't some big national, big name, you know, political consultants coming in and running the campaign. It's people like Ashlyn Cairns, who has been on his political team for a long time. She's now the campaign manager for his presidential campaign. So that says, you know, two things. One, he's got a loyal group of staff who've been with him for a long time. It also says maybe he's not a top-tier candidate who can attract the big-name talent that you might want to have.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe his leadership style?
Well, he's a very positive guy, basically. He's sort of colorful in his language. He likes to be very descriptive about just various things. He's not necessarily known as a detail-oriented governor or a governor who is the best deal maker with the legislature, for example. His staff might disagree with me on that. I will say an exception to that would be on climate policy and clean energy policy, where he does get down into the weeds. He likes the details of clean energy, he's always touring solar plants and biofuels facilities wherever he goes. So on that level, he's definitely more of a details guy. But on the bigger picture level, he's more of a sort of projector of Democratic values and the state's values. And I think he's pretty effective at that.
Mm-hmm. And finally, before we go, Jim Bruner, I wonder if you can leave us with something about Jay Inslee, perhaps a story that reveals something about him, something that we may not have heard about him in the national media coverage.
Sure. I mean, one thing that people may not know, and this has, I mean, I guess there's been a little bit of discussion of it nationally, but Jay Inslee is a doodler and a sort of a wannabe artist. And he doodles a campaign. One of his aides once told me it's sort of like some people smoke to relieve stress. Jay Inslee doodles. And he's sort of gone from doodling to painting. He even he writes these books for his grandchildren. He sort of self-published one called Elvis and the Elves, which is a story, you know, a children's story about climate change, basically, with his illustrations. And, you know, it's actually, the illustrations are kind of cute. They're not bad for a children's book. So it would be interesting, you know, if you were to make the White House, you know, how he would take his artistic skills there.
All right. Thank you very much. Jim Bruner is with us, joined us, a political reporter for the Seattle Times, getting a home state view of the governor of Washington State, presidential candidate, and we know now, doodler, Jay Inslee. Jim Bruner, thank you so much for this home state view.
All right. Thank you.
Coming up after a short break on this News Buzz edition of River to River, I'll be talking with Katarina Sestaric, our State House reporter here at IPR. This is the story about the sudden and, until now, unexplained termination and about a lack of transparency from the governor's office in the dismissal of Jerry Foxhoven, the head of the Iowa Department of Human Services. Also interesting, Tupac Shakur, the late rapper, figures into this story, so you'll want to stick around for our second hour, half hour of News Buzz. Also, thoughts from an astrophysicist here in Iowa on the 50th anniversary of the lunar landing. Plenty more to come on this News Buzz edition. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
No changes. Wake up.
This is the music of the late rapper Tupac Shakur. And on this News Buzz edition now, an update on the news story of a rap music-loving Iowa official, Jerry Foxhoven, who a few weeks ago was abruptly asked to leave his post as head of the Iowa Department of Human Services by the governor, Governor Kim Reynolds, joining us to walk us through what we know and don't know about this Iowa story that also has become a national obsession. Katerina Sestarek, a State House reporter for Iowa Public Radio. Katerina, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben.
I see you filed on iowapublicradio.org a new story about this. So are we any closer to finding out with an explanation of why Jerry Foxhoven was terminated?
I don't know if we're any closer, but the national attention on his story has certainly brought some new information to light, because he has been talking to some national reporters about his love for Tupac. And so although the governor did say that, or the governor's office finally did say that the emails he sent about Tupac were not a factor in her decision to ask for his resignation, some new information has come to light. And so yesterday, in an interview with a reporter from Pitchfork, which specializes in music news, Foxhoven said that Reynolds' staff asked him to do something he thought was illegal and he wouldn't do it, and then he was asked to resign. He wouldn't say what they asked of him, and the governor's office says that they have no idea what Foxhoven is referring to and that he never raised a concern like that to them.
Hmm. Okay, Katerina, take us back to where this story starts. Where do we need to jump in?
So about a month ago, Reynolds abruptly asked Foxhoven to resign, or at least it came as a surprise to a lot of people, especially because it was about 2 weeks before a big changeover in the state's Medicaid program. One of the private insurance companies that manages the state's Medicaid program was going to be leaving and another one stepping in. They were also in the middle of contract negotiations between the state and these companies. A lot of people were worried about that. And there was also a federal trial over disciplinary practices at the Eldora School for Boys, which involved DHS and Jerry Foxhoven. And there were also a spike in patient deaths at a state-run institution for Iowans with severe disabilities. So there were a lot of controversial things sort of happening at DHS at the time.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about what we know about the day of this forced resignation, I guess, according to Foxhoven.
According to Foxhoven, and this is from an interview with NPR, he said that he didn't really know why he was let go so abruptly. At least that's what he said on Wednesday. He said that the governor's chief of staff came in, told him that the governor wanted to go in a new direction, and then basically took his phone and ID and said, don't go back to your office. I haven't been able to confirm that with the governor's office, but that's what he said. And a Des Moines Register story yesterday showed that the meeting between Foxhoven and the chief of staff was set up in advance.
Okay, up to now, just a regular story about an unexplained termination, a lack of transparency, you might say, from the governor's office. But let's get to the national obsession part. Where does Tupac Shakur come in?
The Associated Press had a story this week. They did a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information request, got all these emails that showed that Foxhoven was a big fan of Tupac. And so he would regularly quote Tupac lyrics in emails to employees. And the reason people started saying Foxhoven got fired because of Tupac, which according to the governor's office is not true, is because of the timing of it. The last email he sent that was company-wide or agency-wide to all his employees the Friday before he was let go was reminding them to celebrate Tupac's birthday by listening to some Tupac. And so people kind of connected the dots in their head there, thinking that that was the reason he was let go.
Mm-hmm. I'm not well acquainted with Tupac and his work, but I have seen some inspirational quotes from him in the meantime. And it sounds like you, as a leader, you could perfectly well use some of the quotes from Tupac Shakur. But this is really, how many media outlets has this been on in the U.S.?
It's really blown up. I mean, like I mentioned, NPR and Pitchfork paid attention to it. The New York Times paid attention to it and had a story. And then there's just been a lot of spinoffs. I mean, if you're on the internet, all over the place.
Okay. So tell us, what are still the big questions? Obviously, or is there only one big question? What was the reason for the termination? Or are there others connected with it? What are you looking at in the days to come?
That really is the big question still. The governor has repeatedly said there were a lot of factors that went into the decision and said that she wants to go in a new direction. And so Foxhoven did note in his interview with NPR, he thought the governor probably really does want to go in a new direction and appoint someone more conservative to replace him. But the speed with which this happened was shocking to Foxhoven, he said, and I think to a lot of other people. And so it really leaves the question, was there something else going on? And we don't know at this point. And the governor hasn't provided any details.
Okay. We'll be watching your work and the work of other reporters here in Iowa and across the country. This is an interesting story. Jerry Foxhoven's abrupt dismissal as head of the Iowa Department of Human Services by Governor Kim Reynolds. Speculation as to why, and just to leave us, Katerina, the best we can get from the governor's office as to why is what quote?
There are many factors that went into the decision, and she wanted to go in a new direction.
Okay, we'll leave it at that, see if we can find out more information in the days and weeks to come. Katerina Sestarek of Iowa Public Radio, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and of course, this week we've been celebrating. I'm a big Apollo fan. Back in the 1970s, as a kid, I used to order packets from NASA. You could just put a stamp on an envelope, write a little letter, say that you were terribly interested in the moon project, the shuttle project, too. And in a few weeks' time, you would get a huge manila envelope filled with glossy photos. I was such a geek when it came to space stuff. So this week we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the first Apollo moon landing. Here's Neil Armstrong reading the plaque on the landing gear after he became the first human in history to set foot on the moon in 1969.
For those who haven't read the plaque, we'll read the plaque that's on the front landing gear of this LAM. There's two hemispheres, one showing each of the two hemispheres of Earth. Underneath it says, "Here men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon, July 1969 AD. We came in peace."
Words of Neil Armstrong from 50 years ago. Joining us now, Cornelia Lang, Associate Professor and Associate Chair of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Cornelia, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
We just both beam and smile when we hear and talk about this subject. Isn't it just such a bright star, to use an astronomical kind of figurative explanation? It's really amazing, isn't it?
It has. It's just really been an amazing few weeks. I think we've all noticed that on the internet, on social media, it's just been exploding, really, with this amazing, to celebrate this amazing moment in space history. So many people are revisiting and connecting with this.
Mm-hmm. Let's start off with how we'll get to the UI connection.
Absolutely.
Here, but the UI is having an event to commemorate this?
We are not having an event in our department, but I do want to advertise an event that's happening up in Cedar Rapids at the Pal Dawes Observatory. They're going to have a historic exhibit open at 3 o'clock tomorrow, and at 8:30 there'll be a lecture on Iowa Connection, followed by stargazing if it's clear.
All right. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the science here. What do you see as an astrophysicist, the significance, looking back 50 years, of this monumental achievement? Is it overblown at all? Could it be overblown?
Well, there's some important things I think I can to add to this conversation. I mean, first of all, just the chance to celebrate the achievements of science and technology to get humans to land on the moon and then to walk on the moon is really significant, and I'll come back to that in a minute. We certainly learned more about the moon by landing on the moon. We, as you know, and many of us know, there is a sample of moon rocks that was brought back to Earth, and those actually circulate. Sometimes they even come to the University of Iowa for our students to examine. And so we really learned a lot about the surface composition and the atmosphere and the sort of astrophysics of the moon. Broader, you know, really the work, in my mind, the work leading up, the 10 to 15 years leading up to that moment that we'll celebrate on Saturday tomorrow, the process of science where you had 10 years of designing, testing, constructing, and basically running experiments through the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo program really the crowning achievement then was the landing that we celebrate tomorrow.
Okay, and tell us about an Iowa connection directly to this Apollo landing, because getting on the moon, if you know, the Saturn V rocket,
right,
30 some stories high, lifts off a few days ago, 50 years ago. But it's a very small part of that. It actually makes it to the moon. And there's an Iowa connection there?
Well, there's a couple of Iowa connections. And this is going to be highlighted in the exhibit at the Paldow Observatory. Of course, the deepest connection is that University of Iowa built the first instrument that ever flew in space. So that really paved the way for the whole idea that you could put things and eventually humans in space, especially scientific instruments. And there were a lot of scientific instruments on that Apollo 11 spacecraft measuring different things. There's a Rockwell Collins connection, the radio transmission that transmitted those beautiful words that we just heard from Neil Armstrong. That was pioneered partly connected to Rockwell Collins technology. And then I just learned that in the Quad Cities, there was an aluminum plant that helped to manufacture and was a proponent of the material that went into that Saturn V rocket.
Hmm.
There was also a scientist out of Altoona, Dr. Hobolt, who worked for NASA, and he was a proponent and really responsible for advocating for the lunar orbital rendezvous maneuver that ended up being the successful one that was used.
So, right. So someone had to think of that to have Michael Collins stay as the commander.
Right.
Orbiting the moon while
right.
the Eagle came apart.
Right, right.
From I'm getting my technology terms are not coming to me as they did when I was a teen in the 70s, obviously. And then go down to the moon and then
right.
then come back up and redock
right.
with that and then find your way back to Earth. We celebrate it today. But it was not uncontroversial at the time, was it?
Right.
In terms of spending how much money
right.
on putting someone on the moon when, and we can say it today,
right.
a lot of problems we could put that money for otherwise, right?
Yes, absolutely. And when you there's actually been an amazing series that I've been watching with my family on PBS, The American Experience,
mm-hmm.
and they show some fantastic examples of people protesting at the launch site and the director of NASA at the time coming out and meeting with the people and actually inviting several of them to come and watch the launch from a closer spot. And what they said at the time, and I think this is true, is what we decided at that time, the whole country was fairly behind it, was that that was our priority. And I think that one of the lessons we can take away from the Apollo program is when you decide on something and when you fund it properly at the levels that will actually encourage and the development, then you will have success. And so I think that's what we struggle in science sometimes now, to have our work funded properly so that we can get successful results. And I think a lot of us scientists look back and see a time when science was prioritized and when the discovery and exploration of the moon was prioritized and was funded at the levels that you need. But that does come, unfortunately, at the expense of other things.
Cornelia Lang is an astrophysicist at the University of Iowa, talking, of course, about the 50th anniversary of the first Apollo moon landing. We can't have this conversation without talking a little bit about James Van Allen,
oh, yeah.
the space scientist formerly of the University of Iowa, the late space scientist, instrumental in establishing the field of magnetospheric research in space. The magnetosphere is something that's very important that was discovered there. They're now called the radiation belts, the Van Allen radiation belts, named after him. He had a strong opinion, didn't he, about, and I spoke with him
mm-hmm.
while he was alive,
right.
About putting humans in space versus putting just probes out there to
right.
collect data, right?
Absolutely. And so what's interesting is, as I've been asked to talk about Apollo 11 and as many people in our department commemorate this event, we can't help but kind of keep in the back of our minds his legacy opinion, which was you get more bang for your buck scientifically by putting instruments and robots in space than people. There is certainly an interest and a humanities issue about putting humans in space. But in terms of raw scientific results, raw scientific productivity, you will be much more successful if you stick to things that are not associated with putting people in space.
Right. But we have to have the societal will, the political will to fund
right.
this.
And you have to inspire people,
absolutely.
Right? Is that the
yeah.
other side? Is that the
absolutely.
Argument?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it comes down partway in between. I think something that's important, and when we teach introductory astronomy to the students at University of Iowa, one of the things we want to make clear is that there are, that astronauts, while they do some science and they do carry out scientific instruments, we know that from the Apollo missions, from the space station, from the space shuttle missions, the majority of astronomy in my world and space exploration is done by instruments. And mm-hmm. so there is this nice balance you get by inspiring young people by them seeing humans in space, but also inspiring young people by them seeing rovers and landers and instruments that can do kinds of measurements that humans could never do in space at a much lower cost and at a much lower risk to human life. And mm-hmm. so I think Van Allen was, he also, you have to remember, he also grew up and put his instruments on a rocketry system that was less than 50% had more than a 50% chance of failure. Mm. And so in his mind, rocketry was such in its infancy that but more than 50% of the time you'd build this instrument, hopefully you'd have a copy because it may well blow up. If you look at the long list of missions that Iowa had instruments on, many of them in the early years are yellow on our chart because the instrument blew up on the launch pad.
Right.
And so he really developed that opinion, I think, in a time when launching and success was much different than it is now. It's still risky, of course. We know from a couple of the recent tragedies. But
right, the shuttle missions, but also during the Apollo mission, we had that horrible fire in the capsule. This was during a test, I think, an oxygen
right.
fire, and it cost the lives of three
right.
astronauts, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the future. NASA is aiming to send humans back to the moon as soon as 2024, a timeline set by the Vice President Mike Pence back in March mm-hmm. in a speech to the National Space Council. Now, that's the White House's revived space policy body. How much merit do you see in this push for a return to the moon?
I mean, I think that's a really interesting question, Ben. I mean, I think it's been interesting to listen to NASA officials last night. Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins were interviewed by Ellen Stofan and the director of NASA. And they made a lot of wonderful comments about, us being outside of our planet and being able to look down and see it as not only our Earth, but also as one of many astronomical bodies. And so I think we are at a time when we desperately need to get perspective on our planet. And so I see a value of going back to the moon to be able to look back at Earth and have a slightly removed view of our planet to try to get a picture of how we feel at it. Certainly there's science to do. There's research in our department right now, instrumentation research, thinking about some of the properties like the magnetic field of the moon. And I think in general, exciting young people and, again, putting resources toward exploration and discovery is always a good thing.
Well, thank you very much. Delightful to have you with us. Cornelia Lang, Associate Professor, Associate Chair of Physics and Astronomy in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks
Cornelia.
So much. It was great to chat.
Well, let's finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River by grooving into the weekend with Mark Simmet, IPR Studio One host. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
What do you got for us to take us into this weekend that starts off hot, and I'm really hoping the forecast holds up that we're going to cool off by Monday morning. I'm on Ragbri. I need a cool off.
I don't envy you that assignment. We have a band that's firmly in the genre of rock music. They are the Raconteurs, and that might be one of the last of the great band names, I think, for a rock band. They started in Detroit in 2005. The best-known member by far is Jack White of the White Stripes fame, one of the many projects he's been involved in the past several years. They've kind of sporadically released an album. This is only their third after forming in 2005. The new record is called Help a Stranger, and this is one for the weekend. It's Sunday Driver.
Let's listen.
Come on. Rock Contours Sunday Driver. I think we'll go out with this. Keep this a little bit under me, Dennis, and we'll go out. Mark Simmons of Iowa Public Radio Studio One, thanks for grooving us into the weekend. I want to mention on the out here that I'll be away next week. Actually, I'll be here. You'll hear me, but I'll be away. I'll be on Ragbri, and we'll be getting daily updates. I hope to be delivering some highlights that I encounter with Team NPR. No pie refused. During Ragbri, sort of an experiment, not quite a lunar landing, but I'm feeling some trepidation. You can subscribe to a podcast, Bike Shorts, that will have those updates. Just go to your favorite podcast platform, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, and subscribe to Bike Shorts. But you can hear it here on River to River all next week over the noon hour. Have no fear. Go to iowapublicradio.org to find more information about Bike Shorts. Look for the big white sprocket at iowapublicradio.org and click on that. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Shirley Wong. Help today from Camus Leeson. Camus's last day today. We hope you rock on into the future in good spirit there, Camus. We've enjoyed having you as a colleague. And be well in the future. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.